I could say a lot of things about John, which I may or may not do. At one time, I really didn't like him because I didn't know him, and I didn't know any of his background. And over a period of time, I did get to like him and learned a little bit about, you know, a lot of dislike, a lot of resentments are the result of faulty information. And that's exactly what it was. But I think that John is one of the premier guys in AA in the Atlanta area because of his activity. He's a little bit ahead of me, and he's not that much older than I am, but he's very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I like to see. I like to see people that are sober longer than I am, but are still as active as I am. And I'm not going to take up any more of his time. He talked here about 7 years ago and gave a very prophetic warning, at least in my case. And I hope he touches on it again tonight. And that's, he experienced a divorce many years ago, and he gave some warnings about that situation, and it came true in my own life, because the problem is that everybody divided, and there were people that had support for my ex-wife, and there was people that, most of the people had support for me, because she was only sober about 4 years, and I was sober like 32. So it came down along those lines, and it was unfortunate that it did, you know. And I give you John H. from Lilburn.
My name is John Holmes, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And I appreciate that, Pat. Kind of brings back a few memories for me, too. You know, I really consider it an honor any time to have a chance to share my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. And especially here tonight, because my good friend Bill was good enough to ride over here with me. I wish that my wife were here tonight. She's also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but she was not able to make it tonight. And I always feel a little bit like something's missing when Miriam is not here with me. But she'll come up a little later in my talk. A couple things I need to get established so that we all understand one another. Because there's some things that I have some very strong beliefs in, is that I realize that there's a lot of people sitting out there in this audience tonight who say that I drank for, 10 or 20 or 30 years, and things went to hell in my life, and then I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. That was not the way it was with me. I have more identification with young people today in Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever did before. And I'm going to tell you why. It is my belief that this alcoholic was alcoholic from the first time I ever took a drink. And the reason that I know that is that I've been sober long enough to be able to look back clearly to see when the past started. And the past started for me when I took that first drink. Because alcohol always handled me, I never handled it. The other thing I want to talk about and explain to you is that I hear today in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of discussion about the dysfunctional family. And I want to share with you tonight that I came from as close to a functional family as any human being that you know. I had a mother and father who spent their whole life together and loved each other dearly. There were four boys in our family, and I was raised in the northeastern part of this country. And we had good values in that family. And I was taught how to be the right kind of person. And I want you to know that it's important for me to say that to you tonight, because sometimes I get the feeling when I'm sitting out there in the audience, if I didn't come from a dysfunctional family, somehow or another I didn't belong in this outfit. The reason I became an alcoholic is because I drank booze. Irish Catholic had a lot to do with it too. That's almost like being halfway into Alcoholics Anonymous if you happen to be Irish Catholic. But you know, I have three brothers and they all drink. I have two older and one younger. And I believe for myself that none of them are alcoholics. If you were to see them today, and it's been a long time since I had a drink, and you ran into one of my brothers, and you say, does everybody drink in the family? They say, well, not exactly. And they say, well, what about your brother John? Oh, that was a different case, they would say. Even today, they would say that. And I'll give you a little idea about that. After I had been sober a very short period of time in the West Coast, I used to get invited back by this group of brothers to go deer hunting in northeastern Pennsylvania together. And I was maybe 5 years sober at that time. And what they would do is they would hunt all day long, and at the end of the day they would gather in this little bar and have a drink. And it was called Dorheim's, kind of a local little establishment. And I remember my oldest brother, God love him, he said, we all want to have a drink, except that one over there. And he pointed to me. He said, you see, he can't drink. He's an alcoholic and he's an AA. Isn't that wonderful to announce in a bar? And they're all delighted today that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they remember when. And you know, I didn't have my first drink until I was 15. You know, I hear stories in AA about being drunk at 4 and being, well, I wasn't drunk at 4. I didn't have a drink. I had my first drink when I was 15 years old. And I remember it like it was yesterday. Because if you drank like I drank, you would remember when that all started. And I remember that it was very powerful for me. It was a spiritual experience, because it changed me from this big, tall, skinny drink of water into an eloquent Don Juan. And I thought that I was really something. The first night that I ever drank, I had a blackout. First time out of the box. I had a memory loss and could not remember what happened. And that never changed for me. Now, I'm not trying to tell you I had a blackout every time. But every time I got into my little game, I would have a blackout. And I experienced those right up to before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also had a distinct change of personality. I became a person that I didn't even know. And it was very unpredictable, the person that I would turn into. Now, I'm talking about a set of parents that I love deeply, and I had a very special relationship with my father. is that I always knew where I stood with my father. I knew that I had total love and acceptance for my father, and I worshiped this man. He did not drink. I was 16 years old, and I came home from the local establishment, and I remember that I came home in a snowstorm. And it was one of those snowstorms which was the first in the Northeast. And any of you that came from that part of the country, it was a very dry snow. And I remember staggering home, and I feel that snow crunching underneath my feet. And I made it to the back steps of our house, and I passed out on the back steps. Next thing I know, my father comes out on the back porch, picks up his 16-year-old son, and brings him into the house. This was the man that I loved and respected and adored. And he sat at that kitchen table as he was fixing a cup of tea for me. And this little old man was sitting there with the tears running down his cheeks, saying to me, "Where have I failed you?" And you know what? I knew that I was going to have to get out of that town. Because you see, I didn't want to break that man's heart anymore. And I knew that if I had to make a choice about whether I was going to continue to drink or break his heart, I knew that I would drink. So I became possessed to get out of that town. And I finally graduated from high school in 1952. I'll solve all your problems for you. I'm 63 years old. If you're trying to add it up, because I see sometimes people out there, you know. I'll be 64 in November of this year. In 1952, I graduated from high school, and I had a great decision to make. And my great decision was, I was not college material, I was an alcoholic in bloom. And I didn't want to go to work in a shoe factory for $35 a week, so I decided I was going to go into the service. And of course, you know, stupid me, what I did is I chose a branch that has a place over here and a place in South Carolina called Parris Island, South Carolina. And I was a guest of the United States Marine Corps. And I wasn't in Parris Island 24 hours, and I realized I made a terrible mistake. I should have taken that job in the shoe factory for $35 a week. I'm also going to tell you another little bit of magic that happened in June of 1952. Is that I weighed 141 pounds, about the same height I am now, and a good wind would have blown me away. 13 weeks later, I left Parris Island, South Carolina. I weighed 175 pounds, and I was like a piece of spring steel. And I knew that that I was going to be headed out to the West Coast, because I was going to become part of the 1st Marine Division. One of the things that happened to me is that I went through my normal drunk time and that 10-day leave that I had, and finally they all chipped in and bought me an airplane ticket to get me the hell out of that town. They said that I had smashed up all the automobiles in the family, and they decided to get rid of me. And I went out and I landed in Burbank in those days. I don't believe that LAX was even in existence. I flew into Burbank in 1952 and landed in Southern California, and I thought that I had died and gone to heaven. You know, if you grow up in the coal mines in northeastern Pennsylvania, and your exposure to the world is Parris Island, South Carolina, those are not exactly the garden spots of the world. And you know, I came into Burbank and I went into Los Angeles and I got on a Greyhound bus. And the next stop that we made was in a place called Santa Ana. And that Greyhound bus went out across the prairie and there was a little place called El Toro that was about the only thing that was out there. And we wound across the prairie and we went down into a little ravine there and through the lemon groves. And we came into the little village of San Juan Capistrano. God, I read about this place in books when I was in school. And it was absolutely beautiful. And we wound out of there and we wound out to the Pacific Ocean. And it was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Southern California in those days was a paradise. And I thought to myself, if I ever get through what I'm going to, I'm going to come back and I'm going to live in Southern California because this is where I want to stay. And I made that decision at that time. I went to Camp Pendleton, reported in. And I went through my training in Camp Pendleton and I also went to cold weather training in a place called Pickle Meadows, Nevada. And eventually I got shipped overseas. And I became what they refer to as a replacement in the 1st Marine Division. Any of you wonder what replacements are? These are either people that had their tour ended up or they got killed. That's what a replacement is. You take somebody else's place. It was about 8 months later and I was fortunate enough to leave there and ended up in Japan. And I had only been in the Marine Corps just a little over a year at that time. And I had an opportunity at that time that I could have come back home to the United States or I could stay in Japan. And I decided that what I was going to do was I was going to stay in Japan. Because I already found out what the price of booze was in Japan and other things that were very attractive there. Some other people have been there too. And so I decided that what I was going to do is I was going to stay. And at that time they were just forming the 3rd Marine Division in Japan at that time. And I reported in, and although I had only been in the Marine Corps just a little over a year, I was already a buck sergeant. I don't know how that happened, but I was. And when I reported in, they asked me what I would like to do. Now, I had not been asked at any time in my entire life in the Marine Corps what I would like to do. And I said, well, what do you have? And they said, well, we have an opening in a weapons company. And I kind of cleared my throat a little bit, hoping he would mention something else. And he said, by the way, we also have an opening for a staff car driver for a high-ranking officer. And I said, you got yourself a man. So I became a staff car driver for a major who was a Navy Cross winner in the Second World War. And I became the major's staff car driver. John, the blooming alcoholic, became the staff car driver for the major. And I could explain this whole period of time, and there were many experiences during this period of time. But he was very good to me. One of the things that I can explain in this period of time, and I drove a staff car for a long time for him, drunk and sober, but mostly drunk. That green Chevrolet would be leaving the base on Friday night, and Sergeant Holmes would be in the driver's seat and the major would be sitting in the back. Sunday night, that Chevy would come back through the gate, the major would be driving and Sergeant Holmes would be passed out in the back. And why he ever let me get away with that shit, I don't have the slightest idea, but he did. And I also want to tell you that I was advancing into the disease of alcoholism and didn't even know it. You know, I can remember many times being down there in the motor pool on payday. And I would take my little rack and I would take my we got paid in script in those days. You get paid in American money, you got paid in script. And I remember making piles. And you know what those piles were? That was my drinking money to take me to next payday. That's the way I would think about it. Even in those days, that's the way I would think about it. I never was able to accomplish all those little piles because I always seemed to drink those up very quickly in the first part after payday. But you know that physically I could respond real quickly. And I remember also one of the things that happened to me, I had developed a tremendous capacity for booze. I mean, I could drink a lot of booze and still stay on my feet, even in a blackout, drive in a blackout, converse in a blackout, and people didn't know I was drunk. Or at least they didn't confront me with it. And I used to think that was a great star for me, that was a wonderful thing, that this great capacity that I had. I didn't have the information that was a very dangerous thing that I had. Finally, the time came and I had to come back to the United States. And you know, I was going to come back, and I came back with the division and we came by ship. And I had 30, you know, in the Navy, if you have a convoy that's coming back to the United States, you only travel as fast as the slowest ship. So what we did is we had 30 days coming back from Japan back to the United States. And we landed in San Diego. I remember this like it was yesterday. We were down there and they took all these jar heads and unloaded them. You know, we marched up to Balboa Park. Got to Balboa Park and they had all these six-bys there and all these jar heads were going to get aboard these six-bys. And of course you had a lot of people lined up along the way. This Mexican guy is standing there, he's got two half-quart. I didn't even know they had half-quart cans of beer. Both of them open. All of those jar heads standing around. The one that he walked up to hand the two half-quart cans of beer to was me. I don't think I got sober for the next 3 months after that. But you know, I had great ambitions. I really wanted to do things in my life. But you know, I was chasing two things at that time. I was chasing girls and I was chasing booze. And you know what? If you get them confused, it'll get you in trouble. And that's exactly what happened. I got them confused, and I got myself in trouble. And I got tangled up with a young lady in Los Angeles. And she was a good girl. She was a good person. But she didn't have the slightest idea who she was dealing with. And she had decided that what we were going to do is we were going to get married. Which we did, just shortly before I got out of the Marine Corps. And I had no business at all marrying any human being. Because I was going to take that young lady to places that she had never intended on going to. I was going to take her into a life that she did not welcome. Because what you saw was a guy who was only interested in a couple of things. I was interested in how to make a fast buck. I was interested in keeping up a good front, fancy clothes, and a fancy car. And I could talk my way into a lot of things. You know, I was all flash and no go. I had no substance. You know, I always looked good on the outside. And then after they got a hold of it for a while, they're trying to figure out how the hell are we going to get rid of this guy. Because you see, I never did anything. I just looked good. And I didn't care anything about family. I didn't care anything about children. I didn't care anything about the things that are important to other people. All I wanted to know was where the next drink was coming from. And I drank with the same phonies that I was, trying to convince each other in the bar about what big shots we were, spending money that we didn't have. And that was the sum total of my life. I went to work for Prudential Insurance Company, and I worked for them for a year before they caught up to me. I stole $3,300 of their money in that first year. They should have put my ass in jail. All they wanted to do was to get rid of me. And they fired me in a sales meeting in the morning in the Green Hotel in Pasadena. And I thought Prudential Insurance Company was going to go broke after they fired me. And I worked for them for a year and never sold anything. I never did anything except try to convince you that I was something that I wasn't. You see, I thought so little of myself, I thought that what I could do is I could buy your respect in the next round of drinks. And you know, I took that with me every place that I went. It came time for us to have the first child, and she's a beautiful little blonde-haired girl that was born. Christine, our first child. And I was off drunk someplace. And I went through a series of jobs, and a series of jobs, and a series of jobs. And my in-laws sat me down one time. They had bought a house for us in La Puente, California. And they bought this little place for us hoping that it would help us. You know, by that time my son was born and I had been through like 20 jobs. Because by now people were wise to me. And at this little kitchen table they were going to have a family meeting. Did you ever have one of those family meetings? God, that's terrible. You're hungover, and the meeting is about you. And about what you must do. And I remember sitting there, and all I could think about was, when can I get out of here and get a drink? Because I was about ready to jump through the window. And finally, when I thought that they had finished, they got kind of quiet. I stood up and I said, you can all go to hell and kiss my ass because I'm going to live my life the way I want to live it. And I remember it got dead silence. Now, they were paying all the bills in my house. And you know, about this time in my life, I lucked on to the best job that I ever had since I got out of the Marine Corps. But before I tell you about this job, I'm going to tell you something else. You know, I was having this terrible problem going on. Because you see, the great capacity that I talked about before, it left. The great capacity left. And I was searching around, like it says in our book, about switching drinks and trying to all kinds of things in order to get that capacity back, and I couldn't do it. I'd have a couple of drinks and I'd be a blubbering idiot. And you know, the great outside exterior was starting to go. The cheeks were getting red and the eyes were shut. And when they did open up, they were just bloodshot black holes is what they were. And I was lifeless. And I had gotten to the point in my life when the only thing that I could find that would stay down and keep down and allow me to have some kind of sanity was a couple of young guys that were had a business going in Southern California by the name of Ernest and Julio Gallo. And I was doing my best to see that they stayed in business. And you know, it was no longer the fancy cars and the big front and the fancy clothes. Now I was turning into the pathetic drunk that many of us became. I certainly did. And I got this job at the Los Angeles Times, and I don't know how the hell I got that job. I really don't. It was in the days when they had two newspapers in that town. They had the Times and the Mirror. And I went to work in their advertising department, and they hired a whole bunch of us at one time. And I used to have the feeling like I hunkered down in the middle of the crowd, and they just didn't know what they had hired until after they got me. And the newspaper business is where there's a lot of drunks. And it's kind of hard to stand out. By God, I did. You know, and I was working in this advertising, and I was trying my best to hang on to this job because it was the most money that I had ever made. And it's really hard to conduct business when those little beer and wine bars, you know, in Los Angeles, those dark little places, when you walked out on the street and the sunlight would hit you and about blind you, you know. Because that's where I lived. And I'm trying to be, this little family out there is trying to figure out what the hell is wrong with Dad. I got two little kids, they're little babies, and they're terrified of their father. And I'm a husband to a woman who's scared to death of me. Because she doesn't know what's coming in the door. She doesn't know whether that smile means that he's happy tonight or whether he is angry. She doesn't know whether to try to wake him up because she doesn't know what kind of an animal is going to come out of that bed. And my life is a terror. At work, I'm working in this newspaper in this classified department. You know, we've got high school kids working in this classified department. What they were, a little paste-up. They'd take this newspaper glue. Anybody have any experience with newspaper glue? God damn it, they could fly spaceships with that stuff. I mean, it'll stick anything. These high school kids would come in. Now, here's this Irish Catholic drinking sweet wine. You can imagine what's happening. I look like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know, just all flushed all the time. Look like I'm about ready to explode. And they think that this is a great guy to play practical jokes on. Now, you got to understand, I'm trying desperately to hang on to this job. Got it? And they're trying to play practical jokes on me. We're on the 7th floor of the Los Angeles Times building. In those days in the division, they had these little black telephones. So what they would do as a practical joke, they would take the buttons on the phone and press them down and pour the glue down there in the where the two buttons were. Then when it dried, they would put the receiver back on there. And I would come staggering in, hoping that the sales manager didn't see me, and sit down at my desk long enough to, you know, make an appearance, and they would ring my number from another department. And you see, the phone would ring, and I would reach over and pick it up, and it would continue to ring because the buttons were down. And I was so goddamn terrified, I wanted to jump out of the 7-story window. See, they didn't know what they were doing. You know, I was terrified is what I was, because I didn't know whether it was ringing or not. And I had this little drunk's card that I was trying to, I was trying to kind of make it back and forth just to kind of hold things together. And finally the day came and they came up to me and they said, you need to go see your boss. And I thought, oh shit. And I knew what that was. This was the end, folks. So I came up, I must have done something. I never, to this day, I never found out what it was. He said, I'm going to give you your check. He said, don't worry about cleaning out your desk. It's not important. There wasn't anything important in that desk anyhow. He said, I want you to just take the check, and I want you to leave here, and I do not want you to come back on these premises. Now, you know, they had security guards at Los Angeles Times, even in those days. Now, I must have done something bad. I never did figure out what the hell it was. More than drunk, I guess. But anyhow, I got fired. I had this little check in my pocket. I went down and got my little drunk's car, drove back to the suburban Skid Row in La Puente. And I'm driving up the street, on the street that my house is on. There's a moving van in my driveway. I thought, now, somebody had made a mistake and came into my driveway, but they were loading up the little sticks of the alcoholic's furniture. You know what that stuff looks like? Looks like something that the Goodwill was giving away. That's what was coming out of my house, and they were putting it in this moving van. My wife standing there with these two little babies, and she said, I'm going back home to live with Mom. And I said, well, the hell with you. Good riddance. I can drink with a bandit, is what I thought. I can really be free now. So, you know, they left moving van. Well, in California, what they do is when you abandon a house, they board up the house. Well, they took away the place I was going to live. It was in this house with no furniture. But I had my car. And I was one of those guys who I didn't have any friends. I had no friends. You see, I was the kind of a guy, if you let me get close to you and you had something I wanted, I would take it. So therefore, I was not really popular with people that I had associations with. So I didn't have anybody I could call up and say, I think I'll come over and spend a couple of weeks with you, Charlie. You know, I didn't have any Charlies. So it was just me in the car and Ernest and Julia. So my brilliant mind said, I must set up housekeeping in my car. So what I did is I took my little Renault Dauphine and I took that to the Orange Grove to set up housekeeping. To this day, when I look at one of those little cars, I try to figure out, how in God's name did you ever sleep in that thing, you know? But I did. Well, sleep or pass out, what the hell, it didn't make a much difference anymore. And you know, to this day, I don't know how long I was down there in that car. I've tried to piece it back together because on Valley Boulevard, where that Orange Grove used to be, now is an industrial park. And I knew, folks, that I was all done. I was all finished. All my drinking was done. I was, for all practical purposes, I was a dead human being. And you know, I had great ambitions and great dreams. And alcohol just wiped those right away. And you see, I knew what my problem was before I came to you people. I realize a lot of us come in here and have great denial. I didn't have any denial, folks. I knew exactly what the problem was. My greatest friend had turned into my greatest enemy. And I was all done. And I had no kind of spiritual life whatsoever. It is my opinion, from the time I took that first drink, any relationship that I had with God started to diminish. And the more drinks that I took, the more it diminished, until finally it was non-existent. And one morning I rolled out of that car early in the morning. I don't know what time it was, but it was early. And I was on my hands and knees throwing up blood alongside that little drunk's car. I had been throwing up blood for a couple of years. That was no new experience to me. And for some reason or other, I knew that I could not go on another day, another hour, another moment. And while I was on my knees on the ground, I cried out, God, please help me. Please help me. And it was a plea for me to be able to live. I had no idea about sobriety. None. And I got a clear, concise little answer. And the clear and concise answer that I got was I should call Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe today that the spiritual awakening that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous took place that morning for me. And what I did is I had unquestioning. I just moved right into the car, and I bleary-eyed, hungover, sick, drove into Los Angeles, and I went to a drugstore, and I called information about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she didn't give me the number. She connected me with the number. She must have realized who she was dealing with. And a gal answered by the name of Sybil. And she asked me if I could get to a place called the Southwestern Alano Club. It was on Southwestern Avenue in those days, right in the middle of Watts at that time. It was in the 70-some-hundred block. And she said, if you can get there, she said, there'll be somebody there to talk to you. And as I drove up in front of this place, as sick and as bleary-eyed as I was, I realized that it was right in the middle of the territory I had been fired from the Los Angeles Times. I remember thinking that. It's just a little storefront. It wasn't quite as fancy as this place, folks. And I walked up to the door, and I was about ready to open the door, and a guy opened the door from the inside. And his name was Joe Motes. He was a little guy that worked with a lot of new people in the program. He was the meanest son of a bitch in AA. He was my ideal temporary sponsor, because he knew me for exactly what I was. And he said to me that I asked him two questions. I do not remember this. He said, the two questions that I ask is, how do I become a member and how much are the dues? And he kind of chuckled a little bit, and he said, if you walk across that threshold, Sonny, he said, you can become a member. And as far as the dues are concerned, it's apparent that you've already paid yours. And I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on that day to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the date was April the 9th of 1959. And as of the 9th of next month, by the grace of God, and you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will be sober 39 years in this program. I also want to tell you that in my sobriety, I've done a lot of things that were wrong. But one of the things I have not done is to take a drink. Is that I had a lot of growing up to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's taken a long time. This is also my opinion that sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous is an inside job. And a lot of times in this 39 years, I resisted growing in Alcoholics Anonymous. In our literature, it talks about pain being the touchstone of our spiritual progress. And I'm a shining example of a lot of pain in my sobriety in order to grow up. because I think it's been a growing process for me. You know, the first 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, I want to just touch on that for a moment. Joe Motes was my temporary sponsor. He had an old Chevy that smelled like used wine. And the reason it did is because guys like me sat in the back of those seats. And in the Chevrolet, what you did is, if you were the new guy in the Chevrolet, you sat on the hump in the center of the back seat. And as your sobriety increased, what you do is you gradually moved up. And I remember I had moved up to the middle of the front seat. Not quite, because the door is when you're out after 30 days. And I was coming back, we were coming back from a meeting that he took us to. And in this meeting, in the first 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles in those days, they would take you to meetings and they would have what they call newcomers row, and they'd be right along the wall. That's where all the newcomers sat. And they would say, "We have anybody here tonight who are newcomers?" I always get a kick out of this in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And all those poor asses over there would raise their hand and they didn't want to hear one word out of you. You didn't even introduce yourself. And they sure as hell didn't want to hear anything that you had to offer. And you know, I've thought about it since then, and I thought, you know, maybe that's not such a bad idea. Because if you've ever talked to anybody who's been sober for a year, they know all there is to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. They're an expert on everything. And you know, one of the things that happened that night, I was in that Chevy and I was in that center seat, and I turned to Joe and I said to Joe, I said, "When am I going to get a chance to share something in Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he turned to me with those beady little eyes of his and he said, "What the hell would you have of value to anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous?" He hurt me terribly by that. And you know, one of the things that he did is he put me in touch with my first sponsor. And you know where I lived? I lived in his basement. I think I might still be there. It was so comfortable. You know, I had a shower and I had a bed. I took care of his lawn. I cleaned his pool. I had a great tan. I want to tell you something else that happened very early on. There weren't many young people in Alcoholics Anonymous then in Southern California, but you see, all I was thinking about was myself. Now, I did the outside things, educated them, had a nice home, and all the rest of the stuff. But the truth of the matter is that was a self-centered decision on my part. 1971 came and I had made a great deal of money working for this, more money than I ever had imagined I could make. And I moved to Gwinnett County in Atlanta, Georgia, to start my own business with a partner who was from New Jersey. And we came down here and started the business in 1971, and I moved this family down here with me. Now you see, this was a sick family which I refused to address. I refused to address the sickness in the family, but instead went along my merry way. In 1978, after 7 years in this business, the business was prospering tremendously. The family was getting sicker. And I was part of that sickness, sober in this program. In 1978, in January of 1978, my wife and I divorced, split. 5 months later, my partner of 7 years committed suicide. Same 6 month period. My life was shattered. I felt as if that I was knocked down twice. You know, I think today of those two things that happened to me in that period of time made me have to start taking the responsibility for the actions in my own life. If I was to take the focus off blaming her and blaming him and take the responsibility for the decisions of this family. And after this divorce was concluded, and after I put my partner in the ground, I took 30 days off in my life and returned to Southern California for 30 days. And the reason for my return is to finish that cleanup job that I had started so many years before and never completed. Those are the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, I don't really believe that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous until I was to finish that job. The reason that I can tell you tonight that this is a different guy standing here before you tonight than that guy in 1978 is because up until that time, it was very important to me what you thought about me. Because I didn't think very much about me, even sober 19 years. Today, what I think about me is much more important than what you think about me. I would like you to like me, but that's not imperative today. It's because I had to find my place in Alcoholics Anonymous the same as each and every one of us are going to have to find our place. It is much more important to me, my relationship with God and my relationship with myself and my fellows in this program, than how much you think about me. It is more important for me to be a member in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know that I know today that people say to me today that John is a good guy. And you know something? I can accept that today exactly where it is. Because you know why? It's because I know I'm a good guy today. I know I do the very best that I can one day at a time. And I share with my fellows the same as what was so freely shared with me. And God was gracious enough in 1982 to allow the most beautiful human being, if she were here tonight, you would know this. Pat knows her. Bill knows her. She's a beautiful lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God saw fit to put her into my life, and we were married over 15 years now. In June of this year, she will celebrate 20 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful that my cup runs over. I am so grateful for everything that has happened to me, all the good and all the bad. Because you see, this is a program that I love dearly. This is a program that I try to practice on a daily basis. And I have been given the gift of sobriety by the God that I understand. And I'm going to do everything in my power to protect that precious gift. God love you and thank you.